Tonight's talk is on the indecisive mind. And as I sometimes do for these talks, just to get a feeling for how to approach this subject and what the issues are, I scan the internet for decision making. How to make decisions, I think I've typed in that question and out came 30-some thousand sites. It was amazing. I mean, when you scan down some of them, what the sites consist of. You know, not only how to make decisions, but how to make them right, which I have some real difficulty with. And also, how to psychically empower yourself to make decisions, how to keep ahead of the person that's next to you, on and on. And I couldn't find any spiritual basis on the internet for what I needed to talk about, because to me, the question of how we make decisions and that sense of indecisiveness is a huge spiritual environment for understanding and exploration. We really miss a great deal about the sort of the reflection, the self-image that comes back in decisions, because we get so often get so anxious about making them. We miss the underlying spiritual point of view. And may I say that each of these distortions of mind talk, the point is not to figure out how to make decisions, but to start looking at the pain that is underneath each of these distortions, each of these ways that we hold the world in a slightly skewed perspective, to regain our balance, to regain our footing. And so I've kind of cast a broad net out on these topics to see if we can't to pin down some real issues within them. And the indecisiveness is certainly one that I had fun with myself, because I've never thought of myself as a real good decision maker. And it's often been very painful for me to make decisions, as I always think I can hear the truth in both sides. And how are you supposed to choose when you can't hear one necessarily better than the other? But anyway, so we're going to look at this thing. And the reason I started with the poem about a habit is that we can very easily get into making decisions out of habit. And much of our life really has been kind of passively released over to habit, and let habit kind of navigate our way through the events and activities and decisions of our life. And habit, of course, is not only what we do in our normal and routine past memory and how it comes in and protrudes and continues in the present, but also habit being that we get stuck in thinking that decisions should be made from desire, which is a habit, or away from fear, which is another habit. And we think that we can intuit what decision we make by whether we sense something subtle in our feeling tone associated with the direction that we sense. And as if subtle feelings were not conditioned, and that somehow they were more spiritually based. But they're not. They're not. And we have to get very clear about how it is and what happens at a point of decision, whether we take the left road or the right road, or just not decide at all in that particular moment, and what forces come to bear there. Because that passivity of just allowing our life to be made for us is really not showing up for our life. And if I can say, if Dharma is about anything, it's about showing up. It's about arriving. It's about being present to the decision that's at hand. Now we can go the opposite direction, and everything in Dharma is a matter of balance, but we can go the opposite balance where we never have enough information about making a decision, and we have to study more, and we have to textbook this thing and ask all the experts and do countless searches on the web in order to, you know, to choose some very minor, almost insignificant thing for ourselves. And so we can get too rigid and disciplined in our decision making, or too lax and passive on the other extreme. It's very much like being a Sangha member, if I can just throw in this particular metaphor, because if you're just passively here, just listening to the talk and not energetically participating through volunteerism or through other activities, then you'll get something out of it, maybe, but you won't really feel the community and the cohesion necessary for that sense of sangha to form. It's really a statement of many different aspects of our life, but certainly it falls square center in terms of decision making. And so what does a conscious decision look like? Well, as I mentioned, it means showing up. It means arriving for. It means being present to the conflicting motivations, to the competing desires, to the images associated with that decision, all of that. It also means being accountable. Now, the showing up, that is what we call clear comprehension, where we're not just interested in our own self concerns, but really looking at the implications of the decision in a more far-reaching way, both in terms of time, but also in terms of breadth of influence. And so that showing up requires a kind of a broadening out of sight, of our sight. And in Buddhism, they call that clear comprehension, or the comprehension or acknowledgement of the context out of which that decision is being made. It also means being accountable to ourselves for the decision we're making. And accountability has a lot to do with our ethical background, our ethical fiber, the willingness to take responsibility and to own the responsibility of the decision, but it also to do enough insightful investigation so that we make a responsible and steady decision based upon the information that we have at hand. And I don't know about you, but I've been watching some of these television ads around some of the initiatives that are coming up here in our November elections. And if you want to just watch how many people make decisions, you just watch those ads, because they essentially just take them in and, oh, I'm not going to let the lawyers stuff their pockets with, you know, or I'm not going to, you know, just a kind of a reactive pattern. But when you look at some of these issues, these initiatives, and look at the depth of what is behind them, it really does take a kind of patience and investigation to come to any kind of direction in how we'll vote in relationship to them. And that's just being accountable, that's being responsible in a way for the decisions that we have. And as I mentioned again, decisions can't be just around my own gratification, especially in this time in life. Even the smallest decision really has to include a broader and widening perspective than just what my own concerns are. And so conscious decision making really does include all three of those factors. But the most important one is being present for the decision, rather than just habitually making the same our decision time and time again because the conditions are met on a routine basis. Now, it's interesting. Some people like to keep their options open, so decisions are hard for them. They like to keep their options without being boxed in by having to force a decision. And so they really want to stay free of the binding quality in which a decision forces upon you. When you make a decision, you've obligated something, or you've created an intention for yourself, and there is a restriction in that, because no longer are other options open when you have actually made a decision. And people sometimes feel like that's a limitation of freedom on them, and so they'll escape making decisions thinking that that's somehow more spiritual. And it's not, of course. We can't go through life without making decisions or without being accountable, without standing up for what we believe and making difficult choices. That has nothing to do with Dharma. In fact, just the opposite has everything to do with Dharma. And mostly, keeping your options open may be a form of fear, of feeling exposed or naked in actually choosing something. I don't know whether I should choose that, because to do that exposes myself to other people so they can see who I am and what I'm about. And that can feel very raw and insecure to many people. So let's look. There are three components to decision making that I'd like to talk about if I could. And each of these components has an area of pain that we'll explore a little bit. And then we'll, of course, have a discussion next week on this topic. So we'll keep it going for a couple of weeks as we do all topics. So why are decisions so difficult? That's the question I set off to answer in this talk. Why are they so difficult for us? And it seems to me that there are three components that are difficult in a decision. One is the task of deciding, right? From all the choices you have, what are you going to decide? And we'll look at that. I'm just going to mention them, and then we'll explore them a little bit. The second is the sense of self-image as we decide. What image of ourself comes out as we're making a decision? And that's a huge issue in decision-making. And the third is the comparing mind after the decision is over. The mind that looks around and says, kind of that regretful mind that says, oh, I could have done better, or he or she did better. And so each of those, as you can hear it, have a particular area of spiritual investigation that we need to explore. So let's look at the first one. How do we decide? The task of deciding itself. It's like deciding, you're in a grocery. You have a grocery cart and you're looking at the lines, right? We're going to stay very simple in our examples. And if you're like me, you go, oh my God, which line should I get in? I was staying very simple here. And so what goes through my mind. Well, first, how many carts are in each of the lines, right? But then that's not the only component of that. So how full are the carts? I mean, if you have 10 carts with one item or 5 carts that are filled, which lot, you see? So that's another component. Then there's not but you're not through yet. It doesn't work. The problem is you make all these you still get in the wrong line. And then the last one is, well, how fast is the checker outer working? Because that makes a huge difference, doesn't it? And so you watch them, during this whole time you could be in line. But that's not my way. I spend a good three or four minutes looking at which line I should be in. So the decision making starts working against you just because there's so much a sense of self in making the right decision, isn't there? But we're not quite there yet. That's the second component of decision making. The first component is still is that multiple desire system that's competing for your attention, so that you will make a decision in accordance with that desire. I mean, it's not too different than your decision to sit down and meditate every day, is it? You have the desire, perhaps spiritual yearning, sit down and do nothing. And then the competing desire, intoned by years and years of work ethic, that sitting down and doing nothing is equal to wasting time. That is not insignificant and a huge deterrent in people actually finding their way to the pillow. And there's the competing desire system there. And you think, well, I should do this, you know, but I really must do that. And that kind of waffling is at the heart of this pain, because we don't have a clear intention for our life. We don't know which direction to move. Do we move towards quiet and doing nothing, which seems to be a competing value entirely, than the value of productivity and work ethic, and with the countless echoes from my past of don't be lazy, you know, don't, and all the different intonements of our parents around, you know, not being any good because you're not working hard enough or fast enough or well enough or whatever. And you hear both of those, and they are they're in opposition to one another. And we don't ever settle on one or the other of that as our reason for being. And so Dharma gets shaded somehow. It gets hedged. It requires a full energetic commitment, fully energetic commitment. I wish we could do this on a part-time, like part-time work, right? I wish we could do this like on a 20-hour a week. It doesn't. It requires a full participation. And it's often from those competing desires that we lose that full-hearted response. That willing to say, okay, I'm going to be hearing. It's not as if once you've decided that you're going to sit, that you don't hear the other desire form. But if you believe the other desire form as being equally important, then you're going to be waffling. And it takes an awful long time, I think, for the fruit to ripen sufficiently so that it knows its own direction. An awful long time, it seems. We keep doing a little bit of this and then a little bit of that and never really settling for anything because of those competing desires, those competing points of view. So this isn't a small component of decision making. And sometimes we see the truth in both of them. I mean, yeah, I do need to clean the house, and I also need to sit. Those are two truths. So what do we do with that, with two truths like that? Other times we can't arouse energetically the clarity to make a decision, and so the decisions that being forced upon us, if our energy is low, if we're in depression or despair or just fatigued, can't really be done from clarity, and so they get kind of muddled and confused. And that's another difficulty when we have competing desires. And then perhaps the most significant one is that we're afraid or a fear of how it will turn out. We're simply, it's a risk to make a decision. It's taking a risk. If I go this way, well, I'm not sure anymore. You see, I don't know. What going this way, going that, I don't really know how either one of those will turn out. And it's that fear of, that pervasive fear of insecurity, that pervasive fear of not knowing, of wanting certainty. And again, drawing from a previous talk, being out of control in that moment. Really feeling the embodiment of our own limitation. And being out of control is where we feel most limited. So what do I do? You see, I mean, how can I get assurance of anything? Where is my security that this is going to work? I came upon a Helen Keller, a quote that I thought was good. And of course, Helen Keller was both blind and deaf throughout her life. And she said, so this is from a woman who has no vision and no hearing. She said, security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature. Avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing at all. I just want to let that settle on us for a moment. And we can look at how daring of an adventure is the life we're living. And are our decisions based upon the safety of not risking? So the fear of making a critical decision never comes because we're always navigating around the issue of risk. And we pass up endless possibilities and potentials. I mean, I can certainly see that in my life, looking back and seeing if I had just been a little more cocky instead of safe, things would have turned out quite differently. And you can begin to look, you know, even as an adult, where that sense of conservation and conservatism comes in to bear. So, making a decision about being certain, and so that we're not going to move until we are certain of the direction we're going to go in. And is that possible? See, these are questions that are very important because they show us where we lean as a human being, what we need in order to stay based in security of self, of me, of I. These are not small issues, and it's not a psychological talk. If you hear it as a psychological talk, I suggest you listen deeper. Because at the base of where we're pointing here is the very foundation on what the self is based. It bases itself in security. It bases itself in knowing, in trying to know, in being certain, and not risking, and leaning on habit for our sense of safety. And that feeling of being helpless and impotent, without power, out of control, and we've given lots of exercises over the months and years here on being willing to expose ourselves to that feeling again and again so that it becomes not a crisis for us in the moment that in which we flee to the certainty and safety of higher ground, but rather something that we can hold and actually play within the field of uncertainty, to play within the field of risk, play within the field of unknowing, and being exposed and helpless in the moment. Are we willing to be quietly helpless? It's a tremendously important question for us. So that's the first issue, the pain of making the decision, of trying to reach a decision. And then the second quality is that sense of self-image that comes out during the decision. That's a real interesting one, because if I choose wrong, goes our internal logic, then I am wrong. I was wrong on that one. As if somehow the sense of me depended upon the correctness of our choice. See, we've got it all screwed up. When it comes from a sense of self, then the sense of self needs the assurance that what it does is going to build upon itself in a positive direction. But when it comes from a Dharma understanding, then whether you make a wrong choice or right, the mirror of what comes back and that you learn about, that is where the Dharma is lived. So the decision is a secondary quality. It's the sense of self-image that comes into play in relationship to the decision I'm making, and whether I see that or not, and whether I invite the pain that is at the heart of that image into my life, so that I can feel the pain of a fear of inadequacy or the fear of being a mistake myself. And can I invite that, even in the midst of a decision, can I invite that pain in so that if I do choose wrong, whatever that means, as if there was a possibility of wrong choice, it's not a wrong choice, it's just a choice in which I'm seeing myself as I projected differently than if I had made this other choice. I can hold that. I can learn about that. I can learn from that. From that, you see, there's no... The forms of life aren't what life is about. It's the relationship we have with the forms, because that's what invites the sense of self coming out and arising, taking a posture. So I always want to be right. I always have to have the best. I always have to be secure. Well, that's fine, but that's a miserable life. What is this doing in terms of my self-doubt? I just can't make decisions. You don't understand. That kind of sense of something, you know, is where we're not grounded enough in our life. And again, we're not directed sufficiently to see how to use the fallout of whatever decision we made skillfully so that we can grow and learn from it. There's no right decision. There can't possibly be or even right reasons for making a decision. They're just whether it's important to you, regardless of what others think. And that whole area of mistake, you know, of fretting and feeling the inward pain associated with a choice itself, with having to choose. And that leads to wanting someone else to do it for us. You choose. And that leads to a whole field of experts. And we are a culture full of experts. Everybody has their area. And if you actually sat down with these experts and spoken with them, they're as fragile inside as anyone. Because they're supposed to know, and they don't, for the most part. To come to that fragility and not give away our power, because we see, okay, just do it. Just do it. Just pick it. I choose that one, not that one. Let's just do it. And not out of habit, you have to show up. So it's not a whitewash. Showing up for it, feeling the circumstances and then doing what feels appropriate in that moment with as much clarity. Not saying, oh, I've got to go sit for a half an hour before I can make this decision. Just being more spontaneous with ourselves than that. And not being afraid of mistakes, as I have said. Mistakes are opportunities to learn about our mistaken identity. And mistakes are also a practice for forgiveness. So if you want something spiritual, to work how to work on yourself, feel the pain of not having lived up to your expectations when you make a decision. And then practice forgiveness for not being the ideal that you have created and projected upon yourself. And then move on. And we can really, if we do that, you'll learn how to keep moving regardless of what decision has been made. You won't get frozen thinking that your life is now all screwed up because 15 years ago you chose differently. You chose the wrong mate, the wrong spouse, the wrong this, the wrong that. So that's the second quality of indecisiveness, the image that arises in the decision itself, the image that comes out, very important. And then the third quality is this, what we call post-decisional regret. That is, we see what we lost before we see the benefits of what we have. You know that one? Where you go, God, I stood in this line, I have my grocery cart, I weighed all the factors, and sure enough, and I would say this happens to me 75% of the time, you're in the wrong line. And you've looked at somebody right across from you, you know, you're at Costco or someplace, and you know, four and four, and you've got, you know, that guy's up there, and you're three back. And it's just amazing when you spend a lifetime in grocery lines how much self-recrimination comes and having done it again. You know, isn't that amazing? It's just, maybe you're not. That kind of looking backward. That sort of, you know, what I don't have. No, never mind that kind of regretting. All it does is bring up impatience. I mean, it's the natural connection to being in line when you start thinking in that way is that you're going to breed impatience. I mean, because that's what it's founded upon. Anything that's founded upon time is going to breed impatience. I've got to get through this line fast. Why? As if you aren't going to exist if you don't? What happens to your state of being? You don't get out to the parking lot fast enough. To do what? You see, if you ask, why am I looking for the quickest way through? It's because you feel like there's something that's very important for you to do after you get through. Except it has usually nothing to do with being. It has nothing to do with showing up or being accountable for yourself. It has to do with some task that isn't getting done because you've cut yourself short in time. And so we keep giving away the essence of what the spiritual journey is. Through this projection of regretting, this projection of self-recrimination, we foster ourselves all along the way. And you can see, you can start hearing what it takes to be in alignment with wise view. See, you have to know every one of the strategies of how the self builds upon itself. and how it doesn't want to learn about what it's building and the pain from which it's building upon. And so all of that, just to ignore all of that, because what's really important to me is saving time. As if we could save time. As if there was some commodity called time that we could save. 3 o'clock is what happens where you happen to be when the clock strikes three. It's not something outside of that activity that you are then involved in when the clock strikes three. It's not some external thing. And when we see that, all time becomes our time. That's the switch that's so important. Now, all time is our time. Now, not only is all time our time, but there's no rush in life at all because all time is our time. Standing in line is our time. Being indecisive is our time. And each thing is owned, and we're accountable to each thing all along the way, rather than to the expression of where the decision leads. You see, that way leads to faith. Faith. It leads to being quiet in ourselves. It leads to an untraumatized life. The problem is, though, we keep wanting our agenda. We keep expounding our agenda. What we want, what we don't want, what we fear, what our pleasure is. We keep trying to make decisions and hedging our bets depending upon whether we're going to be satisfied with the outcome. Because what we really want is the satisfaction from the outcome. And that means what? Pleasure. Or some enhancement. And so decisions get blocked, thwarted, obstructed, because we're not sure that that's going to be pleasurable. And so we pull back, don't we? I mean, look at Dharma, for instance. It's so interesting, you see, that your heart is pulling you into this thing, but your mind's screaming that it wants no part of it. I mean, who wants to be a part of losing yourself? From the sense of self, Dharma makes no sense. Does it? Because you're cutting yourself off at the knees. Everything that we are built upon is being questioned. Committing ourselves to not being. Now, what sense does that make? Committing ourselves to not being who we are. Not being me. That doesn't make any. And why would I want to get involved in something like that? And yet the heart keeps pulling us in that direction. And we keep fighting it. And the quicker we get over the fight, because as I've mentioned many times, the train is gone. For most people in here, the train is now going far too fast for you to jump off. But we're screaming, and it's like we're hanging on the bumper of the train, dragging our feet. And so we keep hedging this thing. We have to look at what the components are. Okay, this is difficult. What is this difficulty about? What's the image that's arising that's creating this difficulty in this moment? Why am I hedging? Don't I know the richness of just being on the pillow? The richness of quiet, the richness of having my heart fed. that brings us into conclusion of the talk this evening. See, where is our decision going to come from? Is it going to come from the applied opinion in science and research? Or is it going to come from a clarity of seeing, intoned with a sensitive heart that can feel the implications of what it sees? Knowing that every decision is inherently flawed because it's exclusive. Anytime you exclude something, it's inherently flawed. And so whatever decision we make is going to be flawed. And to be able to forgive ourselves and move on. To move on. Not to keep turning around. We don't have time anymore. I don't care what our age is in the room here. We don't have time to keep turning back. This is a straight-ahead journey. This is a journey that feeds itself by being unfixed. And to move on and to learn about the images that arise in our way, our sense of doubt, our sense of feeling mistake-driven. And every opportunity to make a decision brings forth in abundance the story of my mistake-ridden life. So we do what's appropriate. We just feel what's appropriate. In the moment, you do what's appropriate. So it's not a consistency. Someone said, consistency is the hobnob of the small mind. And it is. Being consistent isn't spiritually advantageous. It's because in the moment, the appropriateness comes from the clarity that's there. And not waiting for some ideal quality of character or ideal clarity of crystal clear clarity to arrive before we take a risk. And they start feeding and enriching the whole sense of growth itself. And slowly we see, as we make the turn from the actual circumstances that come out of a decision, advantage or disadvantage circumstances, as we make the turn from trying to get the circumstances right, from which a decision is made and into which a decision is decided, because it's never been about the circumstances. It's been about the awareness. It's been about the seeing. It's been about the quality of the heart. And so we move into our decisions willing to be mistake prone, willing to be disadvantaged. It's okay. And being completely accountable to whatever befalls the wrong choice. Okay. All of that then enriches the heart. It may not allow for good PR, but it'll make you a hell of a person and a very integritous, heartfelt, sincere, and deeply wise. And may that be the outcome of all of our lives. Can we sit for a minute or two? So if there are any questions or comments that anyone would like to make, you're yes.
Rodney, earlier you said that in retrospect, you wondered what your life might have been like if you had been a little more happy. And I'm wondering if you could say a little more about what you mean by being cocky.
Risk taking. When I talked about earlier, you know, just reflecting now back and saying, essentially, I wish I had taken a little more risks. It turned out fine, from my point of view. And you also see that the consciousness doesn't really have a lot of options at some stage. It's caught in its own patterns of fear and desire. And from the way it's caught and the ignorance that catches it, it doesn't have a lot of movability. It doesn't have a lot of flexibility. It can't maneuver. And so to regret one's past is really not to understand that nothing else could have been done at those critical times. But, you know, it's fun sometimes just to think, oh, you know, if I took an advantage of that, I wonder how it would have turned out. Even though at the same time, I firmly realize that kind of thing, unless you're very careful, no longer remains fun. Can become a source of self-misery in which you breed a kind of remorse in that decisional regret that I was talking about. That's all. And it also helps me when I come to the point in which a risk is necessary to have a little more gumption and a little more impetus to take the risk. You know, let's just do it, see what happens. Yes. She says that when she tunes into her body, she's finding that the body makes better decisions than her mind does. Can you say a little bit more about what it means to tune into your body?
It's pretty radical, but I've been married twice. Both times, even when I got married, I was very ill.
Uh-huh.
And the marriage was great. I mean, it's that rested.
Right. Right. There's some knowing there that isn't being made conscious, huh?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there, I can relate to that. When we were looking for houses, Ellen and I would walk into a house that was on sale, up for sale, and we would we'd feel something. You know, you feel it, and it just feel strange. And I had no idea because it wasn't you couldn't post it on it. But I was very glad that we didn't buy any of those homes, you know, and didn't just whitewash that and say, oh, you know, that's just a feeling. Let's just get over that and make this house work. Because sometimes I do think that the body can be a fine antenna for picking up things that the mind doesn't pick up. And it's often energetic for me. It's kind of an energetic feel of a person or a situation or an event. And I do think that that has, that may sound a little bit in opposition to what I was saying earlier about emotions not being any more reliable than thought. But we're not talking about emotions at this. We're talking about a basic way of understanding the situation non-cognitively. And it doesn't imply an emotion, although an emotion may be there. you can just energetically, it's a different sense. So I do think that sometimes the body is the better antenna to tune yourself to. Yes. Did you come to the talk on shame? I really don't have too much more to say about forgiveness than what I said in terms of shame. What you have to be very careful of in forgiveness is that you're not trying to get over it, which is often the strategy that makes it feel like, oh, this thing just keeps going on and on. Well, yeah, it keeps going on and on, so you just feel it on and on. And so you're not denying the pain of what has occurred. That's the major... You're not trying to get over the pain. You're not trying to say to someone who caused you pain or you having caused that at some point you won't feel the remorse associated with what you did or that you won't feel the bitterness about... in that sense, forgiveness is an ongoing lifetime experience. But that doesn't mean you have to be fixed in relationship to that incident so that your mind is keeps drawing back as a kind of fixed response to your life. You can move things can move on, even though the pain may still be very acute when you remember the situation that occurred. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
I've found that there have been times where you're faced with this competing desire system, and when you have two big truths and you're trying to weigh other people in the picture, and both of them are weighed down, and then what tends to happen is that I'm kind of drained or kind of worn down because of facing these two things. And then you kind of touched upon how if you're in a state of low energy, then it's hard to show up. I'm just wondering if you might be able to touch upon that sort of cycle and those things going together.
Well, showing up and energy are certainly directly related. I mean, energetically, if you are caught in a particular mood or physical fatigue, it's very hard to bring. It's like trying to be fully present when you're ill. It's possible, but it's difficult. There's a lot stacked against you. Showing up isn't energetically difficult because what we are doing is just being present for something, and we just want to be. It's not an exertion of force. It's a relaxation with. If you get too stressed out about the decision you're about ready to make, then you're not going to show up for it. You're going to be caught in the fear component of being wrong. Okay? Rather, it's the relaxation response and just feeling the decision, relaxed, clear, seeing what's there, knowing that there isn't any rightness about either one. There's not going to be an angel that comes down and says, go left, go left. It doesn't happen like that. And that it is going to be in you having made the one decision that you're going to ascertain that kind of comparison only after you've made one of the choices. And then then that's when the regret comes in. So it's showing up, looking around, doing the best you can, seeing the implications of it, and then, okay, left, I go left. And then that's it. Then you don't keep saying, oh, I wish I'd gone right, I wish I'd gone right. Why didn't I go right? He told me to go right, she told me to go right. If I hadn't listened to my stupid Dharma teacher, I would have... You just go left and you walk. You see, you take a step, and then you fall flat on your face. Get back up, you take a step, you fall flat on your face. And you progress at the rate of one step and one body length. because the mistakes you make are actually a progression. Although it seems like you're full of mud, but in fact, it's a progression. So then if you're too concerned about, you know, the circumstances of the decision, you're not going to enjoy the progression you make. You have to change foci. It's like loci. Nuclei. Other questions? Yes, in the back. You have to speak. I can't really. If you could just speak a little louder.
In regards to what you spoke about tonight, it reminds me of what you had said before in one of our other sessions, was that when you take kind of the seriousness of making the bad mistake, that mistakes with reference to where they are actually living.
Right.
You know, and that's
right. Yes, we're talking about living. We're not talking, right, exactly, you see. I mean, the whole thing just gets all screwed up with our image because it reaffirms what we fear we are, which is not up to the task. And so, of course, we're going to see the worst in whatever thing we decide because we believe that we are the worst. And how could we ever decide right when given the particular sense of who I am? But instead of looking at the sense of who I am, we look at the decision as a confirmation of who I am. And the confirmation of who I am is completely misdirected. You see? So we're using life, for the most part, in exactly perpendicular terms to the way it's meant. Sometimes I'm much better spontaneous than I am on the talk, because that's the summation of the whole talk, that last. Yes.
I find that at the stage of my life where I'm looking forward to retirement, one of the things that keeps working in my decision making is this is the last chance I've got to make my life perfect. and I realize that's really crazy.
Severin. Right. Severin says this is the last chance as he approaches retirement, that this is his last chance to make his life perfect. And I don't want to I want to honor the pain of that. It's painful, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you're not going to do it.
No.
And so if you hold on to that as your reason for living, you're going to fail. So be prepared to fail. You see? And so you're setting yourself up to fail, really.
Yeah.
And that's a self-fulfilling prophecy from your image, from your story. What better way to go out than carrying the final chapter in accordance with the rest of the book? But you also have a chance to change the book around. You have a chance to write a new chapter here. So really question that and the pain from which that idealization comes. And the sense of sadness and grief that corresponds to a life that's perceived as having been failed. Because that's what you are saying when you say, I have a chance to make one perfect thing. There's tremendous grief in that. And you have to be honest and accountable to that pain of your past and how you see yourself, and to that sense of how my life just hasn't gone the way I've wanted it to. No one's life has. God, I could have written a better text than the one I'm living. But then maybe it's not about the text. Maybe it's not about the chapters. Maybe it's not about the incidents. Maybe it's something else. And that's what we proclaim in Dharma. We stand up on the rooftop and scream that you don't have to sum up your life in terms of a final chapter or one final epitaph. The proclamation is to look a different way. You see, it's hard. But when we get older, it's hard because of the conditioned momentum that our life has taken. But it also becomes more critical because our time is running out. And so although the packaging of conditioning is heavier, the crisis is also, spiritual crisis is also heavier. So bring forth your understanding here, Severin, and don't let yourself move into the story of your failure. Yes. Where in this community do you talk about the lifestyle conditions that are coming up as you move into a different way? You can do it in the small groups that we have on the discussion nights, or you can do it in the KM groups that we have, and we have several. You pick a KM group that focuses on an issue like your own, and then you get involved and you bring up those topics with a few other people who are also using their life in a positive direction. And you just begin to feel the beauty of that synergy of all of people looking in the same way. Because of our self-doubt, we feel too unsure in ourselves. When we see the truth, but everybody else is going this way, we say, well, I'm wrong. But when you're around a few other people, then you say, oh, yeah, well, maybe it is. And then as that strengthens, and your self-doubt wanes, you have more confidence. And that's how it works. And that's the beauty of Sangha, one of the beauties of Sangha. Okay, was there anyone else before we get to announcement? Okay, thank you. Thank you all for tonight.